My name is Thomas Krenn. I am the Associate Director for Collections here at the Getty Museum, and it is my pleasure to welcome you this afternoon for this afternoon's lecture. Canterbury Cathedral serves as an icon of the Middle Ages. The very name evokes visions of soaring architecture, luminous stained glass, and some of the most famous moments in English history. Starting with its founding in 597 and continuing throughout the Middle Ages, the cathedral was a center for both learning and artistic production and was, of course, the site of the infamous murder of St. Thomas Becket by the Knights of King Henry II on December 29th, 1170. Just 4 years after Becket's death, the choir of the cathedral was destroyed by fire and a new building campaign was proposed. The design included one of the most ambitious plans for stained glass windows of the Romanesque era. 86 life-size figures of the ancestors of Christ. The Getty is honored to have the opportunity of showing six of these magnificent figures in the current exhibition, Canterbury and St. Albans, Treasures from Church and Cloister. Pairing the stained glass with another masterpiece of medieval England, the St. Albans Psalter, gives our visitors the unprecedented chance to view Romanesque art by its finest objects, which are related by their religious function, but differing drastically in scale and context. The windows were meant to be viewed in the communal space of the church, while the Psalter was meant for personal devotion. But when viewed in dialogue together in the exhibition pavilion, they say much about the power of medieval images to communicate and to inspire. Canterbury Cathedral continues to serve as a site of worship, learning, and creative endeavor for the Anglican Church today. And we are delighted to welcome this afternoon's speaker, the very Reverend Dr. Robert Willis, Dean of Canterbury Cathedral. As Dean, Dr. Willis is the cathedral's chief cleric and head of the chapter of the cathedral. And along with the chapter, he oversees all of the cathedral's functions, from its liturgy to the fabric of the buildings themselves. Dean Willis has served at Canterbury since 2001, following 9 years as Dean of Hereford. He studied at Warwick and Oxford universities and obtained his Doctorate of Divinity from Yale University. The dean has been a member of the General Synod of the Church of England since 1985 and has chaired the Conference of Deans of English Cathedrals since 1999. In 2003, he was at the forefront of the launch of the Canterbury International Study Center, which hosts seminarians from around the world, as well as offering courses and presenting conferences. Dean Willis is also well known as a keen musician and pianist, having composed and published numerous hymns. His role as Dean of Canterbury is an ancient and distinguished one. The very first Dean of Canterbury was installed in the year 820. Today, he will share with us details of the enduring spiritual and artistic life at Canterbury in his talk entitled Canterbury, 14 Centuries of Community and Creativity. Please join me in welcoming the very Reverend Dean Willis.
Friends, it's really good to be here after this wonderful collaboration with the Getty Museum for the preparation of an exhibition which, when we arrived, surprised me by its beauty and by the complementary way in which the tiny details of the illuminated St. Albans Psalter, which I had never seen before, are set against the wonderful and monumental pieces of stained glass. I would want, first of all, to thank the Getty Museum on behalf of Canterbury Cathedral for helping us appreciate the treasures that we have. Very often, when you own something very precious for a very long time, you get used to it. and it needs creative friends to help you realize the absolute value to the world and to you of something like this. And the Getty Museum has certainly done this for Canterbury, and I am thrilled that until February that exhibition will be able to be seen by so many who come here. That exhibition is my visual aid this afternoon. Behind me is simply a scene that you could see in Canterbury Cathedral on any midday sunny day, with the glass of the St. Anselm's Chapel being punctured by sunshine and replicated on the wall of the St. Anselm's Chapel. That is 1960s glass, which replaced glass which was destroyed in the Second World War at the time of the Baedeker raid and the bombing of the precincts of Canterbury. We don't consider it to be really very special glass, and the fact that the glass that was there before wasn't taken out in the war means that that chapel has never really had very special glass. And yet, when we see it with the light shining through it, we see another facet of what the medieval artists absolutely realized that a cathedral could be when having this medieval glass in all its windows. It's a wonderful thing to be able to tell your story to someone. And I'm speaking this afternoon as an ambassador to a community which has been stable, more or less, for over 1,400 years and has kept certain treasures and patterns of life which both the glass and the Psalter represent, as we shall see, over those 1,400 years. And all that will still be going on today in Canterbury Cathedral. We're a large creative community. There are 320 full-time paid members of staff, and all of them are experts in one field of scholarship or art or creative ability or another. Musicians, carvers of stone, our own head of stone conservation has been carving a gargoyle here at the Getty for people to see the artifact being actually carved throughout these days. And we believe very firmly that there is nothing which creates an encouragement for the gifts which each human being has, like the sharing and observing of those gifts in another person when they are being exercised with skill and passion and devotion. The story of the glass, let's begin there, is an interesting one, and it's almost an unhappy accident as to why we have come to this position of the wonderful exhibition in the Getty Museum. For in the middle of July, about 5 years ago, the clerk of works, who's the one who oversees all the fabric of the cathedral, came into the office in Cathedral House, where both the receiver general, the administrator of the cathedral, and I have an office, and he was carrying a piece of the cream-coloured Caen stone from the French quarry of which Canterbury is both built and with which we mend it. And he said, "This has split off one of the very long mullions of stone in the great south window." And it's in that great south window, at this period of the cathedral's history, that 22 of the medieval panels of glass of the genealogy of Christ are set. We could see, and architects helped us look, we could see no reason why this stone should have fractured. Usually when a piece of stone breaks off, you see the dirt which has got inside the crack as it's developed and then split. This was a clean break. It had suddenly snapped. And we then had, with a certain degree of intense worry, to decide how we go about finding why it broke and then repairing the crack. We didn't know it would be such a long exercise. We certainly had no idea it would be such an expensive exercise. For what had happened, we found later, was that one of three dangers had occurred. Down below, we thought maybe there's subsidence because a medieval drain goes right through the cathedral underneath it at that point. But no, it wasn't that. Above, works had been carried out in the 1960s which had caused weight to be put on the window itself. And it is a vast window. Those of you who've been there will know how big it is. But no, it wasn't that. It was, in fact, a metal bar placed in the 17th century through the mullions and attached at both sides to keep the window and the glass in place. And with the expansion and contraction of this metal bar, particularly at times like the massive heat of the fireball of the city in the middle of the Second World War, when the city burned to the south of the cathedral, and the cathedral itself had incendiary bombs falling on it, and four old men, called old contemptibles by the Kaiser in the First World War, were throwing off with their bare hands the incendiaries to save the cathedral, and they did save the cathedral. But the southern face of the cathedral was pulled by the heat away. And so all those years later, suddenly the stone snapped. And we had instantly to make protection for the glass our first concern. It was taken out. The 22 panels of the genealogy of Christ that were in that window came down. And our head of stained glass, Leonie Seliger, who has been here for the last 2 weeks helping put up the exhibition, oversaw the taking out of the glass. It was put into store. And the project of the window is a continuing work. We've now been given permission to rebuild the window completely and within the integrity of its outer rim to carve new mullions which go right up through and to set metal bars in a looser way so that there will not be this danger of the splitting of stone in expansion and contraction. And this will be done because of accessibility and creativity, set out on a lawn in front of the cathedral with a tent over it so that our stone carvers can actually be seen by anyone coming, and I hope many of you will, as that great work, and it is the largest work of a window being carved like that in Europe at the moment, is done. It absolutely fascinates me to see how these, our own work staff, can create such things. And some of you will have seen Heather with the gargoyle outside during the last few days. We thought the windows, while they were down, might be beautiful to see. And so in the crypt, which is a darker space of Canterbury Cathedral, though very large, on the west end, we set up four light boxes and placed the life-size panels on the light boxes, four at a time, and left them there for 2 months each. You will know if you've been in to see the exhibition, and if not, please go in afterwards, because this is very, very well worth seeing and experiencing. You will know how suddenly you are eyeballing human figures which have been created, painted, given colour, expression and a diversity of character in the year 1178. Two of them, Lamech and Jareth, were created by the most famous craftsman of all. He is a craftsman that we know only as the Methuselah master, because his most wonderful piece of work, and that has not been allowed to cross the Atlantic, and we had to get permission at a national level to send the six panels of glass across. Methuselah has had to stay at home. But because he is a sort of signature tune of Canterbury, the master who created these, whose name we do not know, but who was one of the most wonderful stained glass colourers and creators of that time in the 12th century, which was a high point of medieval stained glass, is known as the Methuselah Master. Two of them, as I say, are by him. If you come to Canterbury, there are many more pieces of glass by the Methuselah Master who worked in Canterbury in the years, a few years following 1178. Many of them are biblical pictures. And in the wonderful catalogue which has been created to accompany this exhibition, which we ourselves admire so much and has been created by the Getty Museum, you will see a little cameo of Noah receiving the dove back into the ark with the olive branch in its beak. And it says, this glass is wonderfully preserved. I would say this glass is miraculously preserved. For when you think that that was created only 8 years after the murder of Thomas Becket, and through all the vicissitudes of English history, of our Civil War, of the Reformation, of the Baedeker raid in the middle of the Second World War, then it is an absolute miracle that the multitude of stained glass which Canterbury Cathedral possesses is still in place today. I think it speaks of the regular life, as I said at the beginning, of a settled community who throughout history have realized the value of these artifacts and what they mean to the creative life of the community. So that so many things like that have survived. And they've survived to be shared and to help others discover their own creative gifts in whatever field of creativity their gifts belong. Of course, everyone coming to Canterbury, we have about 1.4 million visitors each year. The question on most lips is, where was Becket murdered? And even the children ask this, and we deal with the children differently. We have about 120,000 children in little groups who book in to dress up as Becket and the knights to reenact that particular day. They also reenact the story of much earlier story of Augustine and his monks and King Ethelbert and Queen Bertha. For accessibility and being part of the creative life of a cathedral community, and it's exactly the same in this scholarly community high on the hill here in Los Angeles, is the name of the game. For what those children do in that way, they will never forget. And we find them weeks later bringing in their mothers and fathers and uncles and aunts to say, this is where I sat as Thomas Becket, or this is where I murdered Thomas Becket. That they will never forget. But we're breaking into that story 600 years in to the life of Canterbury Cathedral. It was already a long-established community. We'll begin with Becket because that's where people come from. But it's a little bit like Milton's Paradise Lost or Homer's Odyssey. It begins in the middle if you start there. That afternoon of December the 29th, 1170, was a time when foreboding was right across the city of Canterbury. People knew that the knights were coming, and the Archbishop refused to protect himself. The daily offices of the church went on. Vespers was to be sung, and at the time of divine worship, the doors of the cathedral church are never locked, and there is free access for everyone. And the Archbishop insisted on that afternoon. As part of our creative ongoing life of Canterbury Cathedral in the 20th century, my predecessor, Dean George Bell, was very famous indeed as a friend to those who were suffering so much in Germany under Adolf Hitler, and a particular friend of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was martyred in that time. George Bell commissioned T.S. Eliot to write for Canterbury Cathedral the play Murder in the Cathedral. And we use lines from Eliot's Murder in the Cathedral on the afternoon, always, of the 29th of December in Canterbury Cathedral now. We reenact the events of that afternoon. For just as the windows tell stories, so our liturgy is a constant drama. Every celebration of the Mass, of the Eucharist, of the Communion, whatever tradition you belong to, is actually a reenactment of an historic event, making it alive today. And Vespers on the afternoon of the 29th of December every year is attended by hundreds of people with candles in their hands, and in the darkness of a December afternoon and in a candlelit cathedral, we reenact the Vespers so that the Archbishop to the Plainsong Psalms leaves his throne and comes down to stand at the exact spot of Becket's martyrdom. And there, the lines of Eliot of frightened monks saying, "Bar the doors, bar the doors," and the Archbishop's voice saying, "Unbar the doors, the things of God cannot be guarded by oak and stone," are reenacted until suddenly the office of evensong of Vespers is interrupted by the doors crashing open and there's a great silence. The monks at the time were terrified when the Archbishop was killed, and they wrote the story down. It's one of the best attested martyrdoms in history, as so many of you will know. And they thought the king would be coming with other soldiers to destroy the foundation. They took the Archbishop's body down into the crypt. That's where we go next. And the plain song continues by candlelight on those dark afternoons in December until we come to the altar of Our Lady Undercroft in the crypt, which Erasmus described in his journal as being one of the most holy places he'd visited. And there, the Archbishop says a prayer of the foundation, the historic community of Canterbury, and gives a blessing. And at that moment, as a sign of pilgrimage flowering after Becket's death, all the music breaks from plain song into harmony, and there is a great sense of release and joy as people carry their candles out into the wintry precincts. That kind of drama is simply replicating something of the horror, but also something of the wonder of the fact that appalling things can, again, in the life of a settled and faithful community, result in great good. For it was there that real pilgrimage was established. It wasn't, of course, the first time that people had come as pilgrims to Canterbury, but from that moment onwards, very soon from that moment onwards, pilgrims came. A little after came the king, barefoot, to be beaten by his own word and command, beaten in front of the altar in the crypt, near to where Becket's body at that time lay. Not only did King Henry II come, but in 1179, while the Methuselah master was still working on the glass, he brought King Louis VII of France also to kneel in front of the makeshift shrine of Becket. I often wonder how King Henry felt with King Louis next to him when he had inadvertently, possibly, by his rage, been the agent of that murder of an archbishop in his own cathedral, which rang throughout medieval Europe and caused the fastest canonization in history. And he must have stood there in a very humble way. Recently, 2 or 3 years ago, we had another creative sign of the community. We commissioned a children's opera. It was written by Stephen Barlow, and the words were done by Philip Wells. And lots of children came in to rehearse an opera called King. It was a story of two Henrys who thought that by destroying something, by snuffing out the candle, they would have triumphed. The first Henry was Henry II. The second Henry was, of course, Henry VIII, who destroyed Becket's shrine, partly from fear of the massive international reputation that that cult of Becket and the pilgrimage to Becket's shrine had. And so now, on Becket's shrine space, a candle burns 24 hours a day, and every pilgrimage ends at that point, climbing the steps where the pilgrim's steps are worn by the thousands and thousands of feet which have gone up to the place of Becket's shrine. Nothing is destroyed in spiritual terms, for the candle is still alight, and over the last 20 years, pilgrimages of all kinds right across Europe and the world have burgeoned, so that we've seen an onrush of pilgrimage to Canterbury and from Canterbury, For before Beckett, if we begin to go backwards, and there's good tradition for that in Paradise Lost and the Odyssey, if we go backwards to the beginnings, then already Archbishop Sigeric had set the pilgrim route to Rome in the 10th century, and we still have his journal of the stops that he set on the way, written out with even the bill of how much every hotel cost for him across the way. Some of those communities still exist, like the Abbey of St. Moritz in Switzerland, and there is a tremendous association of Via Francigena, for that's what the route's called, Via Francigena communities who get together to explore what pilgrimage means to a modern human being living in the 21st century and why it is so popular. Why people come at very different points of their life and say, I want to go on pilgrimage. I would commend to you the film starring Martin Sheen with the title The Way, which you can easily get on Amazon. It was released about 4 years ago, because that tells the story of a pilgrimage to Santiago and the very different motives in the pilgrims' hearts, some of them not altogether worthy, and the relationships that they make on the way with the most unexpected people. Well, of course, that could anchor us instantly into another creative work, which is absolutely connected with Canterbury and always has been, The Canterbury Tales by Chaucer. For that group of pilgrims were completely diverse in all their characteristics. And what did they do on the way? Well, they told stories, just as I'm telling the story of my community now. It's a great luxury for a human being to be able to tell another human being her or his story. It's somehow saying, you've given me time to be myself with you. And one of the things that we train our guides and volunteers, and there are about 800 volunteers who assist the 320 paid staff, one of the things we train them is not to speak too much, but to prompt with questions the stories of pilgrims and tourists. And I'm not sure there's a very thick dividing line between the two. Very often we have found that people who come as tourists and walk about in the spaces of Canterbury Cathedral and its precincts, because it's a very vast space, completely walled and gated, so you enter into another world, just as you do here by coming up in the train and feeling as you stand on this great Acropolis-type platform here that you are now given space to reflect and possibly to think your story, to tell your story to yourself, but certainly to be able also to tell it to others that you are with. That's pilgrimage. And Chaucer had it right. But by the time of Chaucer, as I say, the community had been in existence for about 600 years. Augustine founded it right at the beginning, coming across from France and being scared to start with. Don't know what it was about the English that frightened him, but he went back and asked Gregory if he might not come. We have this myth or tale, or it's a charming story that we all used to be told at school, about how Pope Gregory, walking through the slave market in Rome, saw two little fair-haired children chained and said to the slave master, "What are they?" And the slave master said, "They are angles," which in the Latin is angli. And Gregory, at that time, he hadn't become pope yet. Gregory said, "Non angli, sed angeli," not angles, but angels. There's a comic history book in England, which again we all read, which gives the translations as not angels, but Anglicans. And but it was we're told that prompted Gregory, when he heard that this land was pagan. It had been Christian in Roman times, but the Christians had fled to the west and become the Celtic strand of Christianity. And then the new mission of Augustine, came to England with 40 monks and found there in Kent the important kingdom of the southeast of England, because it was divided into different kingdoms at that time, a king, Ethelbert, a scholarly man who already was formulating the laws which would result eventually in the Magna Carta type law of 1215, but already in the Textus Refensis, Ethelbert has the basis of these laws, but he already has a Christian queen. And it's Queen Bertha who says to her husband, "You must receive these monks." And one sees soon after Ethelbert being baptized and then granting the land to Canterbury and then to Rochester and thirdly to St. Paul's Cathedral in London as his three foundations. Augustine set up a community in Canterbury which has been the mother church of all English-speaking Christians ever since. We, at the moment of the Episcopal or Anglican Church, hold it as stewards, but every cardinal, every person coming with an English voice, actually traces their Christian root to the point when Augustine made the English Christian. And from that moment onwards, the root grew and, of course, flowered in many different branches of the Christian Church. But in Canterbury, the community was founded and began to not only take root, but also be creative. One thinks of Archbishop Theodore coming and forming the parish system of the Church of England, making a parish priest responsible for every square inch of the land in pastoral care, worship, and scholarship. And Archbishop Dunstan coming and making the Benedictine rule the absolute basis of the life of Canterbury. And in many ways, it still is. For the hallmark of the Benedictine rule, which is one of the most humane rules that you could think of for community life, is the respect it pays to a human being as a mystic joining of body, mind, and spirit. And the great tenet of Benedict's rule is that all parts of that human being must be given exercise every day, so that mind and body and spirit lived out in community, a community given to hospitality, must have times of study, times of physical work and creative gifts, which are physical, and times of worship, and that all three sides of the human being that you and I are will then contribute to the whole, and there will be an enrichment of the whole life, especially when lived out in community, and a community which welcomes diversity by adding to its numbers daily and subtracting from its numbers daily. For that's what pilgrims do. They come and join us, and while they're there, they change our life for a while and then go on. Tom at the beginning was talking about the new International Study Centre, which has been built on a site where two huge medieval houses stood, which were bombed in the Second World War. The study centre is there so that young men and women who are training for the Anglican clergy from throughout the world in a balanced way, so that there aren't too many of any one nation at any time, and with good scholarships from the Dean and Chapter for those coming from nations that can't afford to send the seminarians if the grant isn't given, can come and spend 4 weeks living the life of Canterbury and adding to the life of Canterbury from their own culture, be it Tanzanian or Korean or from South America. All kinds of culture come. And during that month that they're there, during the Mass in the morning, we have music of completely different kinds and styles of completely different kinds. And what one finds is that during that time, they get to know each other because they're living together, talking together, and sharing their story creatively. We find that they don't agree, but they actually respect one another and grow used to each other. And at the end, there's great sadness when they break up, and some of the best friendships are made amongst those who disagree most firmly, because they've enjoyed the backwards and forwards of the arguments, both spiritual and mental, and they've also enjoyed doing physical things together, worshipping together, eating together, and the rhythm of the day. That settled community where people are together and where space is given to be creative and in a scholarly way thoughtful, as the Getty Museum does here, and as so many communities like Canterbury, and I'm happy that my colleague and friend, the Dean of Westminster, is here this afternoon as well, who'll be talking about his community tomorrow evening. Those communities are precious in our world of today because they give perspective to the dimensions of our life which can become frenetic, and they give reality to our systems of human communication which can become simply electronic. All through those years leading up to the time of the Norman Conquest, when the Saxons had Canterbury in their care, there was a creative life about which we know less than what has followed. For when the Normans came and built in stone, there was a permanence. And they, with their archbishops like Lanfranc and Anselm, brought master craftsmen like our Methuselah master, whose work you can admire. The way in which the windows were set out in the genealogy of Christ, those great lists which you find at the beginning of Luke's Gospel and Matthew's Gospel, are really ingenious. And they caused the whole eastern end, and it's very long, of the cathedral, from the central tower right up to the east end, to be an absolute jewel box of stained glass, and it still is. And the shrine area itself is like a large version of that little reliquary which you will find in the exhibition, which once contained a relic of Becket. You stand at the point where the candle is lit on the shrine, and around you, you are surrounded by the coloured glass of the 12th century. Just as down below in the marvellous St. Gabriel's Chapel, you are surrounded by the wall painting of the 12th century. And also the monks at the time would have been using books like the St. Alban's Psalter, which you can see again in the exhibition, so that the exquisite detail is baptizing the calendar and causing time not to be frightening, but to be something which could be blessed and used by a human being in community or individually. I felt really moved when I saw the Psalter taken apart prior to its rebinding so that we could explore it so well, because we still live our life like that, as does Westminster Abbey. Every month, we still sing through or say through the whole Psalter, starting on day one with Psalm 1 and ending on day 30 at the end of the month with Psalm 150 being sung. Like chunks of poetry, we say or sing those psalms as the absolute thread of our life. And they are signs of humanity's ability to create songs and poetry, and in that poetry to tell stories. And so many of those stories are about journeys. I was reading on the back cover the other day of Huckleberry Finn a quote from T.S. Eliot, who said that Huckleberry Finn is not unworthy to stand beside the great journeyers of history, like Don Quixote and Ulysses. And I know what he means, for that great journey down the river is one of the journeys which enters into the soul of a particular culture and can be shared as an iconic story with others. If Eliot found that, and he was a master craftsman with words, then it caused me to think of Huckleberry Finn in a completely different way. But so many of those stories, The Lord of the Rings is another, which sets out and goes through iconic situations of suffering, danger, gladness, celebration, eating together, sharing stories, and singing. All those things are part of the creative community that is Canterbury today. Recently, we've had one or two new artworks come into the Cathedral Church, and our own craftspeople are massively encouraged by that. We had the sculptor Stephen Cox, who's marvellous with marble, come to carve a new altar over St. Anselm's tomb. It happened most oddly, because I was not expecting a visit from anyone, and two Italian gentlemen, one a bishop, was shown into my library. and said, "We want to give you a gift." I'm always very suspicious when someone says that. "We want to give you a gift, and it is an altar made out of our local stone to stand over the place where our son, who was born in Aosta in the Alps, Anselm, is buried. It took 4 years to get permissions for Stephen to carve this magnificent altar of Aosta marble, which is a sign of the Italian stranger in the middle of all that French stone of a completely different colour. But it is magnificent because the dark green stone is veined with white veinings, which suggest that, like Anselm, you are standing in the Alps, the snow-capped Alps, as you celebrate the Mass, or stand in front of it and look at the altar with the veinings going down. And Anselm had his vision, which caused him to be a Christian priest, in the middle of the Alps, thinking that he was in the banquet of heaven, being invited to share it amongst the snow-capped peaks. Nothing is a better icon of what we're doing at the Eucharist in breaking bread, but inviting all of humanity to share in the rich and diverse banquet of cultural swapping of stories and mutual enrichment. At the same time, Anthony Gormley, the sculptor, has created in the crypt, over the point where they lay the bleeding body of Becket on that awful afternoon, thinking it was the end of the community, he's created, out of nails that we have taken from a medieval roof that we were mending, a human body which hangs suspended in the air, totally transparent in a network of nails, some pointing outwards, some pointing inwards, as though humanity has the capacity to receive hurt and to give it. And he's called this transport because he says it is totally transparent, and the experiences you have as a human being pass through your body, which is the vehicle for all you experience. This cathedral church, he said, is just like that, with the thousands of people who come in here daily passing through, leaving their imprint, but also telling their story. And what we find with every artwork, even Stephen Kindersley's pole outside in the herb garden, which starts Dante's great Divine Comedy off in Italian words carved down this pole, and you see people reading the Divine Comedy up and down the pole. All of those things reinterpret spaces for us, but they're also treasures of a community which makes its family life in Canterbury surrounding the personage, very often absent, of the Archbishop of Canterbury. I always say there are only two things which are which date all the way back to Augustine himself. All the rest have been created or acquired on the way through by the creative skills of the community, which is still doing that today. The first is the human community, which has always been there in an unbroken way, saying its prayers over 1,400 years, living its life, having all the emotions that you and I do. They're not all saints. We quarrel, we scrap, we make up, we laugh, we eat together, we pray together, we sing together, and we entertain guests, for hospitality is another of the great Benedictine words. And the other object, which I held in my hands only a few months ago when I enthroned the new Archbishop of Canterbury and set him in the throne of St. Augustine, the very Gospels, flimsy as that, the very Gospels that Augustine brought from Pope Gregory in 597 to Canterbury, miraculously, like the glass, they still exist. They've been tested in every way possible and found to have complete integrity. And to me, it's massively moving to hold those frail objects in my hand and think, this came from Augustine himself when he came here and is the message from Pope Gregory to found a community and tell the story of that little community of Jesus and his disciples all those years before. The other night, I must stop, but the other night I was here sharing a meeting of friends from the parish of St. Matthew's Pacific Palisades and All Saints Beverly Hills, meeting in someone's house and eating and telling stories again and saying, how long have you been here? The sort of things you ask when you want to know about someone. And there were questions after I spoke, and they said, one of them said, how could you bear to allow the glass to leave Canterbury when it's so fragile and precious? How could you allow yourself to see it go? And I had to say that when it was all packed up and ready, the stained glass department, who were very proud of the glass but also terrified of it going anywhere, asked me to come across and bless it before it came across the Atlantic. And so I went and took water from the pilgrim stoop and sprinkled these six pilgrims as they came across here, Jareth and Lamech and Noah and Tara and Phalic and Abraham. They said, we felt more comfortable at that. And I assured them they were coming to a very Christian land who would look after the glass here. But I think I want to say something deeper about that question, about how could you let that go. Yesterday, we had the profound experience of going to Prometheus Bound in the Getty Villa down at Malibu. But beforehand, the curator showed us around their wonderful classical department. And there in the stories of Hercules at the end is the Garden of the Hesperides, which he had journeyed to see, and the precious golden apples. And you remember that in that story, the apples only benefit the person when they are given away. And I feel that everything that we have which is fragile and precious only becomes precious when it's shared in a self-giving way. It's certainly true of human relationship when you entrust yourself, and it's a risk, to someone else. And I think we believe in our historic community in Canterbury that that's how it is too. When music is sung by the smallest chorister, then that too is a risk, but it's given to others. And when the glass has come all this way across here, it's a risk, but it's given. And it's given in a self-giving way, which, like those golden apples, suddenly benefit the giver. Because already, by the glass being here, I have learned to love it, know it, understand it better. So it's helped my story and helped my ability. When it goes back up in 2 years' time, and I'm sure that there will be representatives of the Getty there, because they're now part of our story as we are part of theirs. When it goes back up, I shall feel that these six old pilgrims have come a very long distance in old age and returned home. For part of pilgrimage is getting to the object you're going to, but the most important part is returning home with all the lessons learned and all the stories heard. They will come back from Los Angeles bringing the air of your wonderful culture with them. And we shall never forget their pilgrimage journey, for anything fragile is better, despite the risk, when it's shared. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for this very personal and intimate visit to Canterbury. Dean Willis has kindly agreed to take some questions. So if you have a question, we ask that you raise your hand and wait for a microphone so we can all hear the question, and probably want to stand up and wave your hand so that Dean Willis can also see where you are. There'll be ushers coming down the aisles with microphones in just a moment.
Yes. I have a question. Those of us who are Californians know about the Bancroft Library here in California, but in looking at information on Canterbury, I realized that you have a Bancroft too, and I wondered if you would elaborate on that.
We have a
Bancroft.
A Bancroft?
Yes.
Yes, I can't elaborate too much on that. It's not something that's made a great deal of, actually. So there is a Bancroft in our lists.
Yes, I noticed.
So that. I must go home and make more of that. Okay. I think. I'm reproved again. There was a question down here.
Thank you for an excellent talk. Very much enjoyed. I just got back from 3 weeks touring some of the cathedrals in England. Was unfortunately not able to get to Canterbury on this trip. But during the tour, the Baedeker raids were mentioned, and that was the first time I'd heard about that.
The
Baedeker raids?
Oh, yes, yes.
And I was horrified to hear about what that was, but I didn't hear much. Could you elaborate on that a little bit, please?
Yes, it was. I mean, I think that at that time, when there began to be a sort of fear that Britain wasn't giving in, and the Battle of Britain was over, a different kind of tactic was tried in terms of attempting to break the nation's morale. And one of the Nazis had a Baedeker guidebook, which gave lists of and plans of the most important cultural sites and those things which were nearest to the English heart. And they decided, most of those places were undefended, of course, because there were no military capabilities attached to them. And so they decided that they would destroy significant areas of cultural heritage. And Canterbury was targeted as one of those areas. And on a night at the... There were three Baedeker raids, but a really big one happened in 1942. And on that night, the Luftwaffe came and bombed down towards the cathedral. But the bombing began to blaze just slightly to the south of the cathedral church. And in the great cloud of smoke, they bombed the fireball, which was the city. So although all around the cathedral there were houses bombed and the deanery itself had the front of it blown out, on the cathedral roof, only incendiaries fell. And as I said, there were four old men. The Kaiser in the First World War said the British Army was contemptible. And so anyone who served in the First World War was called an old contemptible. And these men in the Second World War stood on the roof and with shovels simply threw the bombs off at great risk to their own life, because a high explosive could have killed them at any time. But the cathedral itself was totally saved. And later, the houses around, if they were capable of restoration, were restored. Others opened up spaces which had houses put in them which were of an inferior quality because there was no material to build at that time. But in the late 1990s and early years of the 2000 up to 2003, we built an international study centre which wouldn't have been possible in the congested medieval buildings of the precincts. And so it's turned out to be the most amazing blessing, because anyone can come and stay there. If there's room between the courses and you are within the precinctual walls and able then, when the curfew sounds and the gates are shut, to walk the grounds of the precincts to the floodlit cathedrals in perfect safety. When you come, you'll be charged a commercial rate, and every penny of your profit, of the profit we make from you, will be paying for a Tanzanian or a Kenyan to come and be part of that seminarian's course, or a newly consecrated bishop from Pacific Islands to come across and be with others from throughout the world. And so we've used that to go backwards and forwards. But that was the Baedeker raid. And I'd first heard of the word. Is it in Room with a View by E.M. Forster, where they're in Italy or in Florence without a Baedeker? And I thought, oh, that's a Baedeker. It's a guidebook with cultural sites in.
I would like to thank you for your talk. And before asking my question, I would like to correct the reproval. I believe that a former Archbishop of Canterbury remarked that coincidence is God's means of maintaining his anonymity.
Thank you.
but the question I wish to ask is that your community has done much to restore the architectural and artistic heritage. Has it been doing anything as well to restore the ancient plain chant, that of Sarum and of York?
Yeah, the plain chant itself is part of musical life in Canterbury. Mostly, even songs are sung to Anglican chant when psalmody is on, except in Advent and Lent. And plain chant has become associated mostly with penitential seasons, except when we sing compline, which goes along according to either Sarum chant or Gregorian chant in pure form. But I think there is a great love of plain chant, and people still have in their hearts. We were yesterday at the Master Chorale 50th anniversary rehearsal at the Walt Disney Hall, and they sang the most wonderful rendering in plain song of the Veni Creator Spiritus. And that is so deeply wedded to us all. But at the same time, our library is full of the most wonderful books and artifacts. And last week, we launched an initiative called Doc Explore, Document Explore, which I think eventually, within a few years, will be out on the whole internet. And it was wonderful to go into the library and have the medieval manuscripts, many of which had plain chant as well as the illustrations in, on the big screen there, which you simply turned like a book. And at the same time, the 18th century travel diaries of various of my predecessors were set out in that way, so that accessibility to all of this becomes a major way of helping people to join in with what we're doing and being creative. And when some people see another doing it, then they say, well, I'll have a go too. And it may be that books which have lain dormant for a long time, because these libraries have volumes of handwritten things from people in the past. The other thing, of course, this is an addendum. The other thing I might add is that it's the loveliest thing when you come to something like that concert yesterday in the Walt Disney Hall, and the choir split all over the building and sang Spem in Allium. And, of course, Thomas Tallis was one of our lay clerks, a singer in Canterbury Cathedral. You felt that thread going through. But also, and this is coming the other way, last week, the Saturday before last, I celebrated a marriage of two of our people. One was a former chorister, and he said, my favourite piece I once sung, Omanium Mysterium by Morten Lauridsen. And we had it, and I had the extraordinary thing of the bride and groom in front of me, and the groom was weeping and laughing as this thing was sung, because it is so beautiful. And yesterday we went to the Walt Disney Hall, and they sang as part of their concert, Omanium Mysterium by Morten Lauridsen. And I realised that he was your local composer, and it had been commissioned here. And afterwards, Terry, the president of the society, of the Master Chorale, came up to me and she said, actually, it was commissioned as a Christmas present for me. And I felt that I'd made that connection all the way through in a personal way, and had to come to Los Angeles before I understood Morten Lauridsen, although I was already loving his work over the other. So I think that, you know, there is enormous room for exploration. And because everything survives in these libraries, then a scholar can come and start the ball rolling. So thank you for that question.
Let's take one last question.
I feel privileged to have heard your presentation today. You obviously love the tradition and the history, which you expressed so clearly and well. I'm ignorant with regard to the process of how you got to your position and how your successors will be selected and how your predecessors were selected. Would you mind giving us, at least me, a little insight into that
of
question?
Of course. An hour, we only need to listen. In two or three sentences, the dean of any cathedral, and my brother, the dean of Westminster, will be the same, is a crown appointment. The queen is advised after consultations with the church of which person would be most suitable. until very recently, that was done in a way that was not really known to the person who was being chosen, and a letter would simply fall onto your doormat and say, "This is you." And the one way not to get it was to say, "I want it." But now a little more accessibility and transparency has crept into the process, and the consultation now happens with a committee of five from a particular diocese. There's a chairperson who is a layperson, not a priest, who is used to public life at national level and is a communicant Anglican. He or she will chair the committee of five. The bishop of the diocese, or in Canterbury or York's terms, the archbishop of the diocese, will be a member, but not the chair. There will be another dean of a similar cathedral, who clearly then isn't a candidate for the job, to advise as to what the job consists of, but also is a voting member of that five. And then someone elected by the College of Canons of the cathedral, and someone elected by the bishop's council of that diocese. That makes five, and with them will sit the Archbishop's Appointments Officer and the Prime Minister's Appointments Officer, not with votes, but as advice and with great files about all of us, saying, you know, this is what this person has done, this is what the gifts, this is what they're saying they want to follow. And in the end, a name will come forward by consensus from that, which will go to the Prime Minister, whose only task it is, he doesn't make the choice, only task it is to pass that name on to the Queen. Because in our system, being a constitutional monarch, Her Majesty can only act officially on advice from her Prime Minister. And then the letter comes in the same way as it used to in the past.